Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis, with our co-host, Bullet Lewis. And welcome to the month of October. Apologies that we did not receive the October-November issue until the month was practically over. But the good news is, when the November-December issue is late, we'll read some wonderful things from September for you. So we will start now with some of the daily guides from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. And this month is Ernest Holmes and Jesse Jennings. It's Welcome to Beautiful October and to this set of daily guides. And excuse me, I meant to say the September-October issue. So, no, the life that we see is not the only view. It is a segment of the great whole. Jack Addington. Welcome to Beautiful October and to this set of daily guides. Traditionally, the October guides feature writings by Ernest Holmes, our founder. The header quotes are from some who were fortunate enough to be his personal students. You may recognize many of the names. Several taught multiple generations of leaders. Some worked mostly with private clients, perhaps at the Holmes Institute alongside Holmes. A few collaborated with him on writings. Most contributed to this magazine. These individuals from every walk of life had this in common. In Science of Mind, each found a jewel of a message that they then devoted the rest of their lives to sharing, as I too have done. The close reader of Holmes's works will note that some of his passages have been abbreviated or made gender neutral, with capitalizations and punctuation standardized. Cited books and articles dated after 1960 were collected by his friend and editor, Willis Kinnear, and a few later editors. Closing affirmations are drawn from his little book of affirmative prayers, Creative Ideas, 1964. Ernest S. Holmes, 1887 to 1960, was a philosopher, teacher, prolific author, and an internationally recognized authority on religious psychology. He founded the religious science movement, now well known as Centers for Spiritual Living, as well as this magazine. Contributing editor Jesse G. Jennings compiled the books The Essential Ernest Holmes and More Than We Seem, a collection of his question and answer columns spanning 30 years, published in 2021 year by Spiritual Living Press. Unconditional causes. Your true self is the spirit of you, and the spirit of you is forever complete and perfect. Venice Bloodworth. Now, suppose we had a bottle of liquid and you could turn it into a mold and it would become a human body. Have all the action a human body has. But now something has endowed it with intelligence also. And then suppose, theoretically, you could turn the body back into the bottle, and as you turned it, it would become liquid again. You would know that objectivity and subjectivity are equal, identical, and interchangeable. But you would know there is something beyond both, a something that had will, had volition, had self-determination, and that discovered that energy and mass are two sides of one thing, which may be liquid or solid. Emerson said, "We see the universe as solid fact. God sees it as liquid law." This is the basis of our whole work, that consciousness establishes its own form independently of any forms that is already established, but only when it has a new impulsion or idea or vision in the realm of unconditional causes. The Anatomy of Healing Prayer, 1991, pages 117 through 118. Mind explorers ask what consciousness is and where it is found, as the aspect or vibrational level within us that is willing, volitional, and self-determining, it's pretty much non-locatable, just as intelligence permeates every molecule. But the ideal frame of reference is wholeness, the point being not where the spiritual might leave off and materiality begin, but how they comprise spirit as spirit and spirit as matter. Consciousness establishes consciousness, creative forms, which further evolve into acting as the sponsors of subsequent forms. Affirmation. There is a transcendence coordinating, unifying, causing all the experiences of my life to blend into its unity. Conviction and feeling. There's not a ruler, scale, or meter big enough to measure or even to estimate the size, the ability, the strength, or the importance of the real you. Daniel L. Morgan. Night and morning, try to set apart a time in which to be quiet, to commune with your real self. This is the period in which you clarify your mental atmosphere. Be as relaxed as you can, but neither the position you occupy nor the room has anything to do with the work you are doing. Mostly, see to it that there is no physical discomfort while you attempt to direct your thinking. Now that some of the bodily tenseness, the bane of our rushing way of living, has been released, say with conviction and feeling, I am strong and free through the action of God, Spirit, the universe in me. I am well and successful in everything I do. Repeat this until you feel the thrill of it all through you. It is a wonderful tonic. After this, spend 10 minutes thinking over some part of what you have read, assimilating it, or have a quiet prayer time in which you do not ask for things or conditions, but name them, accept them as already belonging to you, and give thanks for them. The Basic Ideas of Science of Mind, 1957, page 23. The thrill of it all is the key to affirmation, which is a much misunderstood and even maligned spiritual practice. Affirmations don't immediately change everything, just as each successive thought in mind won't usher in a completely different scene. That's not their purpose. Rather, affirmative statements build on each other, and when they are deeply felt, they will work to replace the active scripts embedded in the subconscious that shape our expectations and reactions to incoming experiences. In time, our world will exhibit the corresponding change. Affirmation. I know that through the action of law, my word transmutes every energy into constructive action. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, a couple of selections. And the first one, since we did just have October 4th, the birthday of St. Francis, I will include Saturday's pet blessing. I am grateful for the sacred gift of pets. Today I bless pets and all animals as sacred expressions of the divine. I may care for animals or simply appreciate the beauty and diversity they bring to the earth. I hold a vision of animals' health and safety and give prayerful thanks for them. My care for animals calls me higher and brings out the best of my humanity. In return, I receive my pet's loyalty and companionship. Today, I bless animals by rededicating myself to their care. I give thanks for the blessings of pets and wild animals alike. I appreciate their beauty, strength, and instincts, and the gifts they bring to the world and to my life. Each species is unique and irreplaceable, a blessing to be enjoyed and protected. Appreciation. Appreciation keeps me in a state of gratitude. It can be easy to take the blessings in my life for granted, for the gratitude I feel to be supplanted by the busyness and concerns of everyday life, but practicing appreciation is the best way to attract even more blessings and stay open to life and love. Appreciation and gratitude keep me in a state of awe and wonder, open to the beauty of the world, the kindness of other people, and the benevolence of God, of Spirit, of the universe. With my heart and mind open to the world's wonders, I am simply magnetic. I draw to myself blessings large and small. Synchronicities, serendipities, and all kinds of wonderful surprises come my way when I am appreciative. I live in ease and grace, aware of the presence of God, of Spirit, of the universe, and grateful for every day. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, The Fly at the Window. Faith is the state of being ultimately concerned. Paul Tillich. It can't be helped. We return through different questions to the same central issue. How do we live fully? How do we live in such a way that the wonder of feeling outfuels the pain of breaking? I'm not sure. I am only trying myself, each of us a tiny will striving to find and ride the universal current without perishing. But faith seems crucial. The ability to inhabit the breadth and depth of our compassion, to know, even in the dark center of our pain, that somewhere out of view there is joy and wonder, that even when we tumble, we are part of a current larger than our own design. This is a hard bit of consciousness to ask for, yet even failing, faith, the life of concern, is possible. In actuality, The infinite coherence of all things and events continues like a great bottomless stream, and we, like fish, have but one choice to find and ride the flow. That stream is God, or the Tao, as the great Chinese sage Lao Tzu terms it, and the strength that lifts us when our tiny wills merge with that stream of being is the sacred luminosity we experience as grace. Once in the stream, the life of preparation ends, the life of defense ends, the measuring of individual traits ends, fear somehow gives way to trust, control somehow evaporates into surrender. The fish and stream are for the moment one. The sacred moment and God are always the same. There is nothing else to live for. Even the declaration changes, for it is no longer a living for, but a living out. Always the inner out, and once out and kept open, the whole flows in. So faith is no more than the willingness and bravery to enter and ride the stream. The mystery is that taking the risk to be so immersed in our moment of living in itself joins us with everything larger than us. And what is compassion but entering the stream of another without losing yourself? I remember one summer I was at the window when a fly near the latch was on its back spinning, legs furious, going nowhere. I thought to swat it, but something in its struggle was too much my own. It kept spinning and began to tire. Without moving closer, I exhaled steadily, my breath a sudden wind, and the fly found its legs, rubbed its face, and flew away. I continued to stare at the latch, hoping that someday the breath of something incomprehensible would right me and enable me to fly. Visit a stream if you can, and drop leaf after leaf in its flow. Watch each leaf be carried downstream. Note its dips and turns. Note how effortless it is for each leaf to be carried along. Note how the leaves have no sense of where they are going. Close your eyes, listen to the water, and meditate on how your life is such a leaf in the stream of God's time. Feel the days like water around you. Enjoy the ride. We return to Daily Word for the monthly affirmations for October, or prayers. Inner peace. I cultivate inner peace through each breath I take. Wholeness. I celebrate the expression of God, Spirit, the universe, through me, exactly as I am. Wisdom. Attuned to my inner wisdom, I make decisions easily. Prosperity. With God, Spirit, the universe, as my source, all my needs are met. World order. I give thanks for my place in a peaceful world. And we return to Science of Mind for Eugene Holden's personal affirmations for the month. And I believe I forgot to mention that the theme for this month of October is Glow Up. And that is the heading for Eugene's personal affirmations. I am the light. Declare today that you are the light of the infinite. As the light of the infinite, you bring the power of love everywhere you go. What's great about this is you don't have to try. This is who you naturally are. I am the light of the infinite. Everywhere I go, I lovingly shine my light of peace, joy, and power. I am the light of God, of Spirit, of the universe. Lighten up. With all that's going on, I remember that I have a responsibility as a spiritual entity, having a physical experience, to shine my light where there is seeming darkness. Let's decide to lighten up today. My heart is lightened because I am one with God, with Spirit, with the universe. I am the light of the infinite. I light up every room I step into. Inside out. Being spiritual entities, having physical experiences, we live from the inside out. Now is the time to tap into the inner splendor of our being and glow like never before. Tap in and turn on your brilliance. I am the living, breathing expression of God, of Spirit, of the universe. I live my life from the inner strength that lives, moves, and has its being as me. I live from the inside out. Glow. The body temple is here for a blink of an eye. However, we are eternal beings. And while we're here, let's glow. Let's shine. Let's love like our lives depend on it. I am the eternal spark of the divine. I glow with infinite possibilities. I am supported in all I do. I am the light, and love of God, of spirit, of the universe. And so it is. We return now to the Daily Word for an article by Louisa Rogers, A Willing Heart and a Moment of Grace. I've often pondered what grace is. I know the actual definition. It's a gift from God, a free and unexpected blessing. But grace felt elusive and remote, something I'd heard about but never experienced. And then to my surprise, I had my own experience of it. My husband and I have a loving relationship, 51 years strong, but each of us can occasionally hurt the other. A few years ago, I was reminded of this when we were socializing with a new couple. I was upset with Barry for interrupting me and later changing the subject abruptly after I finished speaking. He hadn't seemed interested in what I was saying. Barry and I have always communicated openly, and earlier in our marriage we would discuss this kind of issue after socializing, but we've learned over the years that these conversations might trigger us to get defensive and argue. We now accept that we're each a bit vulnerable socially. I like to think everyone is. And that our social interactions, while pretty good, aren't perfect and may never be. That evening as we walked home, I was still nursing my resentment, trying to release it by placing my hand over my heart and saying to myself, "Hey, it's okay. It's okay." Apart from that, I had to decide whether to drop in on the last half hour of a women's choir rehearsal at a nearby hotel. The choir was practicing a song that we would sing at a public rally on International Women's Day. I had already told the group I had a previous commitment. I felt no obligation to stop by, and it was already so late, I doubted my appearance would make much difference. Plus, I was tired. Yet the choir director had said this rehearsal was the most important one of all, and Barry encouraged me to go. Approaching the hotel, I thought, oh, why not? As I neared the practice room, I heard rousing, enthusiastic singing. I felt an immediate softening in my chest. The hurt feelings I'd been ruminating over faded, and my eyes filled with tears at the sound of the stirring music. The beauty of women singing together in harmony filled my heart. I was flooded with joy, and the thought suddenly came to me, oh, this is grace! The choir director, who hadn't expected me, grinned broadly at my arrival. My seatmate handed me the music sheet, and a moment later I joined in singing lustily. Later, when I got home, I thanked Barry for encouraging me to go. I could have so easily missed it, not only the sweetness of singing, but more important, the easing of my hurt feelings. As I went to bed, my resentment and hurt seemed trivial in the bigger scheme of things. I didn't feel Barry had been interested in what I had to say. So, had I been interested in all his comments? Had I given him enough attention? But even those thoughts soon slipped away as I drifted into a deep, restful sleep, remembering the stirring melody I'd helped create. The next morning, I woke with the lovely memory of singing and a feeling of peace toward Barry. This experience taught me that far from having to work at releasing any unwanted emotion, transformation can happen in a heartbeat if I'm open to it. Because I'm a stubborn person, my willingness is key. Ever since that evening, I often ask myself, "Are you willing to release this, sweetie?" I can't receive grace if I won't open the door. Willingness lets it in. I had no sense when I approached the hotel that my hurt feelings could be recast as joy. It was not from my will or ego. It just happened. That night, I received the mysterious, unexpected grace I'd heard about, and thanks to my willingness, I have been receiving it ever since. Louisa Rogers is a writer who specializes in spirituality, travel, and physical and psychological health. She divides her life between Eureka, California, and Guanajuato, Mexico. Learn more at authory, authory.com /Louisa Rogers. We return to Science of Mind for Reverend Dr. Andriette Earle's monthly column from the Inside Out, Flow in Faith. Where there is no faith in the future, there is no power in the present. Halford Lukacs. In a recent talk, I enjoyed anthropomorphizing a stream of water and sharing about its purposeful yet circuitous trek to the ocean. The stream wound its way around and through all the large and small boulders and chasms on its way to its intended destination, and it made it look so easy to do. I marveled at its determination to make its way past all manner of barriers to reach this ultimate goal. What if we were equally as determined to accomplish our goals and realize the greater good awaiting us? Are the obstacles in our way any different than the boulders blocking my stream's path? Ernest Holmes says, "The barriers between you and your greater good are not barriers in themselves. They are things of thought. It is because of this that all things are possible to faith." Our worries, doubts, fears, complaints, and unwillingness to forgive are like boulders blocking and eddies stifling our flow. They form the countless barriers that cause us to alter our course, risk our safety, and make it increasingly more difficult to reach our goals and accomplish what we set out to do. While it is always true that the good we seek is also seeking us, we must first believe. Then, in faith believing, we align ourselves with the good seeking us. When we do this, we are essentially choosing a path of non-resistance. The choice empowers us to transmute stumbling blocks into just-in-time stepping stones and make our way safely to our destination. Our faith in our future outcomes strengthens our resolve and endows us with amazing power in the present. I envision and paint a picture of the stream flowing steadily past all impediments, singing songs of faith, gratitude, and blessings along the way. This consciousness works for us as well. When we are willing to bless our boulders, express gratitude and thanksgiving for every apparent barrier, they dissolve to reveal our highest good right at hand. And from the same issue, we turn to an article by a wonderful man named Michael Gott. The great work continues. You can expect a fulfilling life only if you are dedicating yourself to finding out who you are. Stephen Cope, The Great Work of Your Life. The concept of purpose intrigues me. I like the related words calling and vocation. In his wonderful book, Let Your Life Speak, Parker Palmer evokes the words of Frederick Buchner, who defined vocation as where your deep gladness meets the world's deep need. Palmer goes on to say that our world needs everything. Purpose is not just about how we bring our gifts to serve others. It's also about finding fulfillment. When we are living and expressing fully, being our most authentic selves, we give what is ours to give, and we receive the experience that is ours to experience. My journey of discovering and living my purpose has been a long one. I'm blessed to have been born to parents who encouraged me to use my gifts and to follow the doors those gifts might open. My sweet dad worked a job he hated for decades. When I graduated college with a music degree, he told me, "Michael, don't do what I did. God has given you a talent. You need to use it." I struggled, though. In my 20s, I worked hard just to pay the rent, much less earn a living. I was minding my own business, singing and playing at a piano bar in the gay neighborhood in Dallas in the early 1990s, when a man approached me on my break and put $5 in my tip jar. I thought he was going to ask me for a date. Instead, he invited me to sing at a Sunday service for his spiritual community. I had two thoughts. One, what kind of a church has their minister go to a gay piano bar looking for talent? And two, I might have found my church. And I had. Reverend Marty Bacher was that minister. When I asked what kind of music he wanted me to perform, he said, "Anything with a positive message. Show tunes are fine." I showed up on Sunday and sang What a Wonderful World and Somewhere from West Side Story. I usually accompanied myself, but the community had a talented pianist, so I stood. My mouth was dry, my hands shaking, partly from nerves and mostly from a horrible hangover. I think I couldn't have been very good, but something must have clicked. Reverend Marty soon hired me to be the church's music director. That was in 1993. The great work begins. That community was the first church of religious science, now CSL Dallas. I had no idea I would receive much more than the $75 check for singing a couple of songs. I would be given a transformational teaching that opened incredible doors for my life. Soon after, I began a path of recovery. I began to emerge from the dark night of my soul, to reveal more of the truth of my being, and truly discover my life's purpose through writing and recording music inspired by this liberating philosophy. I learned my purpose was bigger than any role or job. Even as my music career thrived, I felt a nudge to do more. I felt the call to ministry, though I have to admit I resisted it at first. But I answered the call, became a minister, and eventually accepted a position as assistant minister at Unity of Houston. When I considered taking on the role as the primary leader of a community, I was afraid of failure, of disappointing others. But the nudge came again, and at one point I asked myself if I wanted to be a senior minister. My answer was a timid yes. I then felt a communication, a message from somewhere, maybe my higher self, maybe the universe, that said, "This will be the great work of your life." After a few years, Unity of Houston invited me to become its senior minister. Before I accepted, I wrestled with myself about whether or not I was up to it. I would run scenarios in my mind. What if there's a financial scandal? What if a schism develops in the community? And being on the Gulf Coast, what if there's a major hurricane? Will I know what to do? 9 days before Reverend Howard Caesar was set to retire, and I was to step into his role, Hurricane Harvey hit Houston. 100 families and individuals in our church were flooded out of their homes, many losing everything. I was overwhelmed and uncertain I could do what was needed. But I wasn't paralyzed. Even while the rains were still coming down, I was on the phone with staff and board members. Who was flooded? What needed to be done? Within a week, our community found itself the point of support for the New Thought Movement's Hurricane Harvey relief efforts. We raised nearly $400,000 to make direct cash grants to New Thought centers damaged by the storm and their affected individual members. This was the first big lesson of what the great work of my life was to be. And the lesson was, it's not all up to me. I didn't know how to do a fraction of the things that needed to be done during those weeks, but I could ask for help from people who had the knowledge, expertise, and wisdom we needed to help those in need. The great work is a we thing, not a me thing. Living our purpose will require us to stretch and grow, to move beyond our comfort zones, but it will also call in all kinds of seen and unseen support. A few years after Hurricane Harvey came COVID-19. At that time, our Sunday offering collections were the primary stream of income for our organization. For weeks and weeks, no offering baskets were passed. Could we survive? My ego was absolutely terrified that this great community that had existed for more than 100 years would collapse on my watch. But again and again, I learned this burden was not mine alone to carry. We got through it together. As we began to reopen, we quickly realized that many people were not ready to return to meeting in person. Our 1,200-seat sanctuary had far more empty seats than full ones. I began to blame myself for our lower attendance. Logically, I knew that this couldn't be completely true, but it felt as though it were. I talked to other colleagues who were experiencing the same dynamics, and that helped. But something within me still felt responsible for our decline in attendance. I recognized that I was bringing some old, unhealed belief to this experience. I knew I was living my purpose, but I was suffering. During our return to in-person services, my sense of well-being was completely dependent on how many empty seats I saw in our sanctuary. Often I felt I was failing. My connection to my sense of purpose felt thin and brittle. The words, "the great work of my life," felt like a taunt. I was doing everything I knew to do to help this community succeed and thrive, and I felt like I was failing. My experience in those months felt as though my ego was put through a meat grinder. It was a crisis of identity. At some point, after trying everything else, I began to surrender. I would later tell my community, "I keep thinking that after all these years of spiritual growth and healing, someday I'll get to a place where the answer is something other than let go and let God. It appears that this is not the case." I began to pray the words of a song I wrote 25 years earlier. The great work is showing up fully. For my entire life, I found my worth and value through what I did. Now, in the COVID and post-COVID struggle, I was being asked to let that go, to do my work in the world without attachment. I was being invited to be my purpose, not do it. And slowly, my experience began to change. I began to not count the empty seats, but rather notice the wonderful people who were in the room. My energy began to loosen and relax. I rediscovered the joy in this sacred work of spiritual leadership. I began to understand that the great work of my life was not about visible success in my job, but rather about showing up fully as who I am, and even who I am not. Releasing my ego's attachment to form has been truly the great work of my life, and it continues. Today, our community is thriving. Lives are being transformed. We don't have the same numbers of people attending as we once did, and our longtime members feel some sadness around this. Occasionally, one of them will approach me and talk to me about it. I can be with them as they grieve the church we used to be without taking it on as my fault. And if they are open to the conversation, I'll direct their attention to all the new people who recently joined us. To them, this is the golden age. Our purpose statement at Unity of Houston is, in community, we nurture and empower each other, transforming our lives that we may serve the world. This is a great work. My personal purpose and the purpose of my community are connected. Saying yes to living my purpose has required me to change and heal, and that freed me to serve others in a cleaner, freer way. Howard Thurman says, "Don't ask what the world needs. Find what makes you come alive and go do that, because what the world needs is people who have come alive." As I look at the faces of the beautiful and diverse community I serve, I see people who are healing, who are coming alive. I see people who want to bring their gift to serve our needful world, and I feel my own deep gladness. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Well, we begin this week with a new book, one that I've been looking at for a long time and finally purchased. And I thought this was a good time for us to be hearing it. The Book of Joy, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu with Douglas Abrams. The Invitation to Joy. To celebrate one of our special birthdays, we met for a week in Dharamsala to enjoy our friendship and to create something that we hope will be a birthday gift for others. There is perhaps nothing more joyous than birth, and yet so much of life is spent in sadness, stress, and suffering. We hope this small book will be an invitation to more joy and more happiness. No dark fate determines the future. We do. Each day and each moment, we are able to create and recreate our lives and the very quality of human life on our planet. This is the power we wield. Lasting happiness cannot be found in pursuit of any goal or achievement. It does not reside in fortune or fame. It resides only in the human mind and heart, and it is here that we hope you will find it. Our co-writer, Douglas Abrams, has kindly agreed to assist us in this project and interviewed us over the course of a week in Dharamsala. We have asked him to weave our voices together and offer his own as our narrator so that we can share not only our views and our experience, but also what scientists and others have found to be the wellsprings of joy. You don't need to believe us. Indeed, nothing we say should be taken as an article of faith. We are sharing what two friends from very different worlds have witnessed and learned in our long lives. We hope you will discover whether what is included here is true by applying it in your own life. Every day is a new opportunity to begin again. Every day is your birthday. May this book be a blessing for all sentient beings and for all of God's children, including you. Tenzin Gyatso, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Emeritus of Southern Africa. Introduction by Douglas Abrams. As we stepped off the plane at the small airport, the howl of the jet engines deafening and the snow-capped foothills of the Himalayas looming behind us, two old friends embraced. The Archbishop touched the Dalai Lama's cheeks tenderly, and the Dalai Lama pursed his lips as if blowing the Archbishop a kiss. It was a moment of enormous affection and friendship. In the year-long preparations for this visit, we were quite aware of what the meeting might mean for the world, but we never realized what a week together might mean for the two of them. It has been a profound privilege and a daunting responsibility to convey the remarkable week of dialogues that took place in Dharamsala, India, at the Dalai Lama's residence in exile. In this book, I have tried to share with you their intimate conversations, which were filled with seemingly endless laughter and punctuated by many poignant moments of recalling love and loss. Although they had met only half a dozen times, the men shared a bond that transcended these brief visits, and each considered the other his mischievous spiritual brother. Never before, or likely after, would they have a chance to spend so much time in each other's company, reveling in the joy of their friendship. The heavy footsteps of mortality were never far from our conversations. Our trip itinerary had to be reworked twice so that the Archbishop could attend funerals for his peers. As health and global politics have conspired to keep them apart, we recognize that this might be their last time together. For a week, we sat in a pool of soft light, arranged carefully to avoid hurting the Dalai Lama's sensitive eyes, as 5 video cameras filmed around us. During our quest to understand joy, we explored many of the most profound subjects in life. We were in search of true joy that was not dependent on the vicissitudes or circumstance. We knew that we would need to tackle the obstacles that can so often make joy elusive. During the dialogues, they outlined 8 pillars of joy, 4 pillars of the mind, and 4 pillars of the heart. These 2 great leaders agreed on the most important principles and offered illuminating differences as we attempted to gather insights that might help readers to find lasting happiness in an ever-changing and often aching world. We had an opportunity each day to sip warm Darjeeling tea and to break bread, Tibetan flatbread. All who were working on filming the interviews were invited to join these daily teas and lunches. One exceptional morning, the Dalai Lama even introduced the Archbishop to his meditation practice in his private residence, and the Archbishop gave the Dalai Lama communion, a rite generally reserved for those who were within the Christian faith. Finally, at the end of the week, we celebrated the Dalai Lama's birthday at the Tibetan Children's Village, one of the boarding schools for children who have fled Tibet, where the Chinese authorities have prevented them from receiving an education based on Tibetan culture and language. The children are sent by their parents over the mountain passes with guides who promise to deliver them to one of the Dalai Lama's schools. It is hard to imagine the heartbreak of parents sending their children away, knowing that they will not see them again for more than a decade, if ever. In the midst of this traumatized school, more than 2,000 students and their teachers cheered as the Dalai Lama, who is prohibited by his monastic vows from dancing, took his first tentative shimmy, encouraged by the Archbishop's irrepressible boogie. The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop are 2 of the great spiritual masters of our time, but they are also moral leaders who transcend their own traditions and speak always from a concern for humanity as a whole. Their courage and resilience and dogged hope in humanity inspire millions as they refuse to give in to the fashionable cynicism that risks engulfing us. Their joy is clearly not easy or superficial, but one burnished by the fire of adversity, oppression, and struggle. The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop remind us that joy is in fact our birthright, and even more fundamental than happiness. Joy, as the Archbishop said during the week, is much bigger than happiness. While happiness is often seen as being dependent on external circumstances, joy is not. This state of mind and heart is much closer to both the Dalai Lama's and the Archbishop's understanding of what animates our lives and what ultimately leads to a life of satisfaction and meaning. The dialogues were about what the Dalai Lama has called the very purpose of life, the goal of avoiding suffering and discovering happiness. They shared their hard-won wisdom of how to live with joy in the face of life's inevitable sorrows. Together, they explored how we can transform joy from an ephemeral state into an enduring trait, from a fleeting feeling into a lasting way of being. From the beginning, this book was envisioned as a 3-layer birthday cake. The first layer is the Dalai Lama's and Archbishop Tutu's teachings on joy. Is it really possible to be joyful even in the face of our daily troubles, from frustration with morning traffic to fears of not being able to provide for our families, from anger at those who have wronged us to grief at the loss of those we love, from the ravages of illness to the abyss of death? How do we embrace the reality of our lives, deny nothing, but transcend the pain and suffering that is inescapable? And even when our lives are good, how do we live in joy when so many others are suffering, when crushing poverty robs people of their future, when violence and terror fill our streets, and when ecological devastation endangers the very possibility of life on our planet? This book is an attempt to answer these questions and many more. The second layer is made up of the latest science on joy and also on all the other qualities that they believe are essential for enduring happiness. With new discoveries in brain science and experimental psychology, there are now many profound insights into human flourishing. 2 months before the trip, I had lunch with neuroscientist Richard Davidson, a pioneer researching happiness. He has studied meditators in his lab and found that meditation confers measurable benefits for the brain. We sat at an outdoor table at a Vietnamese restaurant in San Francisco, the ever-present wind blowing the gray-black locks of his boyish haircut. As we ate spring rolls, Davidson said that the Dalai Lama had once confessed to him that he found the science on meditation inspiring, especially when getting out of bed to sit in the early morning. If the science helps the Dalai Lama, it can help the rest of us even more. Too often we see spirituality and science as antagonistic forces, each with its hand at the other's throat. Yet Archbishop Tutu has expressed his belief in the importance of what he calls self-corroborating truth, when many different fields of knowledge point to the same conclusion. Similarly, the Dalai Lama was adamant about the importance of making sure that this was not a Buddhist or Christian book, but a universal book supported not only by opinion or tradition, but also by science. Full disclosure, I am Jewish, although I also identify as secular. It sounds a little like a joke. A Buddhist, a Christian, and a Jew walk into a bar. The third layer of the birthday cake is the stories of being in Dharamsala with the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop throughout the week. These up-close and personal chapters are meant to allow the reader to join the journey from the first embrace to the final goodbye. We've also included a selection of joy practices at the end of the book. Both teachers shared with us their daily practices, the anchors of their own emotional and spiritual lives. The goal here is not to create a recipe for a joyful life, but to offer some of the techniques and traditions that have served the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop and countless others over the millennia in their respective traditions. These practical exercises will hopefully help you take the teachings, the science, and the stories and incorporate them into your daily life. I have had the privilege of working with many of the great spiritual teachers and scientific pioneers of our time, helping them convey their insights about health and happiness for others. Many of these scientists have generously contributed their research to this book. I am sure that my fascination, okay, obsession, with joy began while growing up in a loving home that was shadowed by the black dog of depression. Having witnessed and experienced such pain from a very young age, I know that so much of human suffering occurs within our own head and heart. The week in Dharamsala felt like an extraordinary and challenging peak in this lifelong journey to understand both joy and suffering. As a people's ambassador, I sat there for 5 days of interviews, staring into the eyes of two of the most compassionate people on the planet. I'm very skeptical about the magical sensations that some attribute to being in the presence of spiritual teachers, but from the very first day I found my head starting to tingle. It was startling, but perhaps it was simply an example of how my mirror neurons, those special empathic brain cells, were internalizing what I was witnessing in the eyes of these two extremely loving men. Fortunately, I was not alone in the daunting task of distilling their wisdom. Thubten Jinpa, the Dalai Lama's principal translator for more than 30 years and a Buddhist scholar, accompanied me from start to finish. For many years, he was a Buddhist monk, but he gave up his robes for a life of marriage and family in Canada, making him the perfect partner for translating between worlds as well as languages. We sat together during the dialogues, but Jinpa also helped me to prepare the questions and interpret the answers. He has become a trusted collaborator and a dear friend. The questions were not ours alone. We invited the world to ask their questions about joy, and although it turned out we had only 3 days to collect them, we received more than 1,000. It was fascinating that the most asked question was not about how we could discover our own joy, but how we could possibly live with joy in a world filled with so much suffering. During the week, their fingers were often wagging at each other teasingly, moments before their hands were clasped together affectionately. During our first lunch, the Archbishop told the story of a talk they were giving together. As they were getting ready to walk on stage, the Dalai Lama, the world's icon of compassion and peace, pretended to choke his spiritual older brother. The Archbishop turned to the Dalai Lama and said, "Hey, the cameras are on us. Act like a holy man." These two men remind us that how we choose to act each day is what matters. Even holy men have to act like holy men, but how we think holy men act, serious and severe, pious and reserved, is hardly how these two greet the world or each other. The Archbishop has never claimed sainthood, and the Dalai Lama considers himself a simple monk. They offer us the reflection of real lives filled with pain and turmoil, in the midst of which they have been able to discover a level of peace, of courage, of joy that we can aspire to in our own lives. Their desire for this book is not just to convey their wisdom, but their humanity as well. Suffering is inevitable, they said, but how we respond to that suffering is our choice. Not even oppression or occupation can take away this freedom to choose our response. Right until the very last minute, we did not know if the Archbishop's doctors would allow him to travel. The prostate cancer had returned and was slow, this time, to respond to treatment. The Archbishop is now on an experimental protocol to see if it will hold the cancer at bay. As we were landing in Dharamsala, what surprised me most was the excitement, anticipation, and perhaps a touch of concern on the Archbishop's face that could be seen in his wide grin and twinkling blue-gray eyes. And I looked to see the publication date, which was 2016. And Archbishop Desmond Tutu did pass away at the age of 90 in December of 2021. Arrival. We are fragile creatures. We are fragile creatures, and it is from this weakness, not despite it, that we discover the possibility of true joy, the Archbishop said as I handed him his sleek black cane with the silver handle shaped like a greyhound. Life is filled with challenges and adversity, the Archbishop continued. Fear is inevitable, as is pain and eventually death. Take the return of the prostate cancer. Well, it does focus the mind. One of the side effects of the medicine the Archbishop was taking is fatigue, and he had slept for most of the flight to India, a beige blanket pulled up over his head. We had planned to talk on the flight, but sleep was most important, and now he was trying to share his thoughts quickly as we approached Dharamsala. We had stopped off in Amritsar for the night so he could rest, and because the airport in Dharamsala was open for only a couple of hours a day. This morning we had visited the famed Harmandir Sahib, the Sikh religion's holiest site. The upper stories are clad in gold, resulting in its popular name, the Golden Temple. There are four doors to get into the Gurdwara, which symbolizes the tradition's openness toward all people and all religions. This seemed like an appropriate place to pay our respects, as we were embarking on an interfaith meeting that would bring two of the world's great religions, Christianity and Buddhism, into deep dialogue. As we were swallowed into a throng of the temple's 100,000 daily visitors, we got the call. The Dalai Lama had decided to meet the Archbishop at the airport, a rare honor that he bestows on very few of the endless stream of visiting dignitaries. We were told that he was already on his way. We raced to get out of the temple and back to the airport as we pushed the Archbishop in his wheelchair, his bald head covered by an orange handkerchief, a required sign of respect at the temple, which made him look like a day-glow pirate. The van tried to inch its way through the traffic-choked streets of Amritsar as a symphony of car horns played, the mass of cars, pedestrians, bicycles, scooters, and animals all jostling for position. Concrete buildings lined the roads, their rebar sticking out in an always unfinished state of expansion. We finally made it to the airport and onto the plane. We wished that the 20-minute flight would go even faster, concerned now that the Dalai Lama would be waiting on the tarmac. Discovering more joy does not, I'm sorry to say, the Archbishop added as we began our descent, save us from the inevitability of hardship and heartbreak. In fact, we may cry more easily, but we will laugh more easily too. Perhaps we are just more alive. Yet as we discover more joy, we can face suffering in a way that ennobles rather than embitters. We have hardship without becoming hard. We have heartbreak without being broken. I had witnessed both the Archbishop's tears and his laughter so many times. Well, more his laughter than his tears, in truth. But he does cry easily and often, for that which is not yet redeemed, for that which is not yet whole. It all matters to him. It all affects him deeply. His prayers, in which I have been enveloped, reach around the world to all who are in need and suffering. One of his book editors had a grandson who was ill and on the Archbishop's very long daily prayer list. Several years later, the editor asked if he would once again pray for his grandson because the child's illness had returned. The Archbishop replied that he had never stopped praying for the boy. From the plane, we could see the snow-covered mountains that are the postcard backdrop to the Dalai Lama's home in exile. After the Chinese invasion of Tibet, the Dalai Lama and 100,000 other Tibetans fled to India. These refugees were temporarily settled in the lowlands of India, where the heat and mosquitoes had led a great many to become ill. Eventually, the government of India established the Dalai Lama's residence in Dharamsala, and the Dalai Lama was very grateful for the higher altitude and the cooler weather. Over time, many Tibetans came to settle here as well, as if the community was heartsick for the mountainous landscape and high altitude of their home. And of course, most of all, they wanted to be close to their spiritual and political leader. Dharamsala is in the North Indian state of Himachal Pradesh, and the British, when they ruled India, also used to come here to escape the relentless heat of the Indian summer. As we approached this former British hill station, we could see the green carpet of pine trees and agricultural fields below. Dense storm clouds and fog often closed the small airport, as it did on my last visit, but today the sky was blue, the wisps of clouds held at bay by the mountains. We descended for the steep landing. One great question underlies our existence, the Dalai Lama had said before the trip. What is the purpose of life? After much consideration, I believe that the purpose of life is to find happiness. It does not matter whether one is a Buddhist like me, or a Christian like the Archbishop, or any other religion, or no religion at all. From the moment of birth, every human being wants to discover happiness and avoid suffering. No differences in our culture or our education or our religion affect this. From the very core of our being, we simply desire joy and contentment. But so often these feelings are fleeting and hard to find, like a butterfly that lands on us and then flutters away. The ultimate source of happiness is within us, not money, not power, not status. Some of my friends are billionaires, but they're very unhappy people. Power and money fail to bring inner peace. Outward attainment will not bring real inner joyfulness. We must look inside. Sadly, many of the things that undermine our joy and happiness, we create ourselves. Often it comes from the negative tendencies of the mind, emotional reactivity, or from our inability to appreciate and utilize the resources that exist within us. The suffering from a natural disaster we cannot control, but the suffering from our daily disasters we can. We create most of our suffering, so it should be logical that we also have the ability to create more joy. It simply depends on the attitudes, the perspectives, and the reactions we bring to situations and to our relationships with other people. When it comes to personal happiness, there is a lot that we as individuals can do. We lurched forward as the brakes seized the tires, and then the plane rumbled and shook, stopping quickly on the short runway. Out the window of the airplane, we could see the Dalai Lama standing on the tarmac, a large yellow umbrella held over his head to protect him from the bright Indian sun. He was wearing his maroon robe and red shawl, although we could see a small patch of saffron yellow on his sleeveless vest. An entourage of office staff and airport officials in suits flanked him. Indian soldiers in khaki uniforms were providing security. The media had been kept outside of the airport. This was going to be an intimate reunion with only the Dalai Lama's personal photographer taking pictures. As the Archbishop hobbled down the steep stairs in his blue blazer and signature fisherman's cap, the Dalai Lama approached. The Dalai Lama was smiling, his eyes sparkling behind his large square-framed glasses. He bowed low, and then the Archbishop spread his arms out and they embraced. They separated and held each other's shoulders, gazing into each other's eyes as if trying to convince themselves that they were really together again. "I haven't seen you in a long while," Archbishop Tutu said as he touched the Dalai Lama's cheek tenderly with the tips of his fingers and inspected him closely. "You look very good." The Dalai Lama, still holding the Archbishop's small shoulders, puckered as if to blow him a kiss. The Archbishop raised his left hand, gold wedding ring shining, and clasped the Dalai Lama's chin as one might do to one's precious grandchild. Then the Archbishop went in for a kiss on the cheek. The Dalai Lama, not used to kisses from anyone, flinched, but also laughed with delight, which was quickly accompanied by the Archbishop's high-pitched cackle. "You don't like a kiss," the Archbishop said, and gave him another on the other cheek. I wondered how many kisses the Dalai Lama had received in his whole life, taken from his parents at age 2 and raised in a rarefied realm far away from kisses. They stopped for the formal presentation of kata, a white scarf, a Tibetan custom of greeting and respect. The Dalai Lama bowed with hands pressed together at his heart, the gesture of welcome that recognizes our oneness. The Archbishop took off his fisherman's cap and bowed in return. The Dalai Lama then draped the long white silk scarf around the Archbishop's neck. They whispered into each other's ears, trying to talk over the noise of the jet still droning in the background. The Dalai Lama took the Archbishop's hand, and then they were more 8 than 80, laughing and making jokes together as they strolled toward the terminal, yellow umbrella sheltering above them. Even though the Archbishop's white scarf was bunched around his neck, it still hung all the way down his small body. The size of the kata one gives is a sign of the esteem that one holds for the recipient, high lamas receiving the longest ones. This kata was the longest one I had ever seen. The Archbishop joked throughout the week, as kata after kata was draped around his neck, that he felt like a human coat rack. We were ushered into a small room with a couple of brown couches set aside for the Dalai Lama to await his often delayed or canceled flights out of Dharamsala. We could see the media gathered outside the airport, lining the glass wall, waiting for a chance to snap a photograph or ask a question. It was only then that I recalled how newsworthy and even historic this trip was. It had been so easy to get lost in the logistics and to forget that their time together was an important event for the world. Well, we come now to the end of our program, and we're definitely continuing with this book on joy in the upcoming weeks. As always, I ask if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please call the station and ask them to email me or call me and let me know. And as always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.